Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Russia's Sputnik Radio, and Radio Havana Cuba. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan. The massive oil spill in the Indian Ocean now extends along 30 kilometers of the island of Mauritius. According to German doctors, Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny was poisoned. COVID cases have escalated in most European countries. Spain is trying to tackle the spread with local lockdowns and the military. NHK Japan.
It's been 1 month since a Japanese-owned cargo ship ran aground on a reef off Mauritius. Now the United Nations estimates an oil spill from the Wakashio extends for about 30 kilometers along the island nation's southeastern coastline. About 1,000 tons of fuel oil leaked into the Indian Ocean after the bulk carrier broke up. There are fishing ports and mangrove forests along the coastline. A member of a Japanese relief team sent to the scene says the area's coral-rich shallow waters, less than a meter deep, are making cleanup efforts harder. A local police official told NHK the Wakashio was navigating in different waters from usual at the time of the incident. The Coast Guard attempted to contact the vessel several times, but there was no reply. The crew finally responded after the ship ran aground. Earlier, authorities in Mauritius arrested the ship's captain on suspicion of endangering safe navigation. Turning to the latest on the alleged poisoning of an outspoken opponent of the Russian president, European media report that the toxin German doctors say they found in Alexei Navalny's system is the same nerve agent used against a former Russian spy. Navalny is being treated in Germany after falling ill on board a flight to Moscow last week. His doctors say they discovered a toxic agent that inhibits communication between nerve cells. German public broadcaster ZDF refers to the nerve agent Novichok. The cholinesterase inhibitor was used in the 2018 attempted murders of former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Britain. British public broadcaster BBC says Navalny is being treated with the same antidote used for Skripal. So far, the Kremlin has dismissed international calls for an investigation into the alleged poisoning. A spokesperson says there's not enough evidence to say what sickened the prominent politician. Turning now to Europe, where Spanish Prime Minister has pledged to beef up its country's measures against the virus. Pedro Sanchez says the government will mobilize 2,000 military troops to support the coronavirus contact tracing process.
We cannot allow the pandemic to take control of our lives again. We must stop the second wave of infections.
Sanchez announced on Tuesday that soldiers would be available to make up for a personnel shortage in the work to track and trace infections. He also said the country will allow regional officials to declare lockdowns, something for which the central government was so far been responsible. Spain saw the number of new cases drop to several hundred per day at one point. But a rapid resurgence occurred in Madrid in the northeastern state of Catalonia in July. The number of new daily infections has occasionally topped 3,000 since mid-August. Meanwhile, Italian Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio on Tuesday met with his Chinese counterpart in Rome. Italy is Wang Yi's first stop on his European tour. The two countries have confirmed that they need to forge closer economic ties amid the pandemic. Johns Hopkins University in the United States says the number of cases worldwide has now topped 23 million, with the global death toll exceeding 810,000.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 5975-7245 and 11970, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The Supreme Court of Belarus has rejected an appeal by the country's exiled opposition leader to annul the recent election. More than a dozen Hong Kong opposition leaders have been arrested. The city of Berlin has banned an anti-mask rally protest called for this weekend. The United Nations Security Council blocked an attempt by the United States to reimpose sanctions on Iran, with only the United States and the Dominican Republic voting in favor of it. Iran has agreed to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect two sites suspected of storing undeclared nuclear material. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The Supreme Court of Belarus has rejected an appeal by the country's exiled opposition leader to annul the results of the recent disputed presidential election. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya challenged the outcome last week. News of President Lukashenko's re-election triggered mass protests amid widespread allegations of vote rigging. Two prominent Hong Kong opposition lawmakers are among more than a dozen people arrested in connection with last year's mass anti-government protests. Lam Chuk Ting and Ted Hui were detained after early morning raids on their homes. The arrests are being seen as part of a widening crackdown on opposition figures in the territory.
The city of Berlin has banned an upcoming weekend protest against coronavirus restrictions, citing concerns about spreading the virus. Authorities broke up a similar protest here earlier this month, where thousands of people ignored social distancing rules. Germany has seen its COVID-19 numbers surge in recent weeks.
The UN Secretary, Security Council has blocked a bid by Washington to reimpose sanctions on Iran. In a video conference, the council's president said there was a lack of consensus in the UN's highest body over U.S. strategy on Iran. 13 of the 15 council members voted to reject the American bid.
Iran has agreed to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect two sites where the agency suspects undeclared nuclear material might be stored. Now, the IAEA head, Rafael Grossi, and Iranian leaders said they'd already agreed to dates for the inspections. Iran had earlier denied inspectors access, prompting Washington to point to the issue as evidence that Tehran should not be trusted. The agreement comes a day after the UN Security Council blocked a U.S. demand to reimpose sanctions on Iran. All right, for more on these developments now, I'm joined by Trita Parsi. He's one of the founders of the National Iranian American Council, which represents Iranians in the U.S. He's also vice president of the Quincy Organization for Statecraft. He joins me tonight from Washington. It's good to see you again, Mr. Parsi. I mean, this looks like a conciliatory move from Tehran. Will the Trump administration see it that way?
No, I think the Trump administration will be quite frustrated, because what they probably wanted was a crisis between the IAEA and Iran, which they would then be able to escalate further. Early on in the Trump administration, in the Trump years, they actually went to the IAEA and were trying to strong arm the IAEA to request access to a variety of sites, and the IAEA pushed back because they had no clear evidence that would justify such a request. Later on, such a request was made by the IAEA, and the Iranians have agreed for inspections at two of these sites. It seems like partly as a result of the IAEA also saying that they don't have any further questions beyond that. It does not seem likely that this was independent of the UN Security Council decision. Had the UN Security Council caved to Trump, it seems unlikely that the Iranians would have been forthcoming when it comes to the IAEA request.
Yeah, you mentioned the UN Security Council decision. It blocked U.S. efforts to reimpose sanctions. I mean, how is that going to impact the Trump administration's strategy towards Iran?
Well, the Trump administration's strategy towards Iran is a failure by all accounts, because it has not been able to do anything positive on the nuclear front. On the contrary, the Iranian program is less restrained now than when the Trump administration was inside of the agreement. Moreover, when it comes to Iran's regional activities and all of these other things that Trump promised that he would push back against the Iranians, we've seen the opposite. We've actually seen the Iranians counter pressure the U.S. by being more aggressive in various places. So it's failed on that front, but it's also failed on what probably was its core objective, which was to escalate matters towards a conflict. And we've seen how Europe and Russia and China and other countries essentially have closed ranks and are protecting the agreement and pushing back against efforts by Trump that clearly have been designed to kill the deal and spark a crisis. And so right now, we actually don't have a bigger crisis than what we otherwise would have had Europe and China and Russia not done this.
We know that President Trump has repeatedly said that he's prepared to do a deal with Iran. We know that Iran says that the 2015 nuclear deal is still alive, says it's hobbling on crutches. So do you think there's any likelihood that we're going to see any breakthrough before the November election?
Not at all, because the Iranians have no interest in negotiating with a Trump administration that they probably believe is in its last months. Moreover, as long as Pompeo and others are still in the Trump administration, who the Iranians have no trust for, because they have seen how Pompeo and Bolton and others were undermining efforts to negotiate a deal between the United States and North Korea, those factors all make it, you know, essentially impossible for the Iranians to see any value of any negotiations with Trump. With Biden, however, it will likely be quite different.
Trina Parsi, it's always good to get your insights on this.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, tw.com. Next, Russia's Sputnik Radio. George Galloway interviewed Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News. Recent MI6 revelations have shown that the coup in Iran in 1953 was led by Britain wanting to secure oil rather than the U.S. wanting to keep Russia out. And that coup created ripples and tidal waves that continue to the present day. Galloway and Loria discuss the history of modern coups orchestrated by the West, including Guatemala, Chile, Syria, and Ukraine. Sputnik Radio.
Imagine, if you will, a pebble thrown in a pond as long ago as 1953, which is still causing tidal waves today. Actually, you don't have to imagine it, for that is precisely what happened when Britain and the United States and others plotted and succeeded in overthrowing the democratically elected Iranian Prime Minister, Dr. Mossadegh, replacing him with the Shah. No Shah, no Ayatollah Khomeini. No Ayatollah Khomeini, no Iraq-Iran wars. No Iraq-Iran wars, perhaps no Gulf wars. And, of course, the reverberations continue, and not just between Iran and Iraq. The entire region of the Middle East, the most strategically important in the world, for now at least, is still shaking as a result of that pebble thrown in 1953. A man who knows all about these plots and plans is Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News, and I'm delighted to welcome him back. Joe, we now know from new revelations just how deeply the British were involved in the coup. against Mossadegh. Most of us took comfort from the fact, if comfort is the right word, that it was your country, the United States, that did most of the heavy lifting. But that wasn't entirely true, was it?
No, it was very much a British coup, wasn't it? And in fact, it was interesting that these revelations showed that the Truman administration was not interested, that they did not agree, with Britain, that the communists, the Russians, would eventually take over when there was one Tudor party member, that's the Iranian Communist Party, in Mossadegh's government. So it was only, in fact, in February of 1953, when Alan Dulles was appointed director of the Central Intelligence Agency by the newly elected and inaugurated president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, that the Americans went along with the British plot. And it was for the U.S. really a reversal of 1776, George, because instead of removing a king to bring in a democratic government, we took out a democratic government and put a king back on the throne. The following year, Dulles helped organize, of course, the coup in Guatemala, overthrowing another democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz. And, of course, the Dulles Brothers Bank had worked with the United Fruit Company, which basically owned almost all the land in the country. In 1949, there was the CIA's first coup in Syria, in which an elected leader was overthrown for a general, again, because they felt the Soviets were going to take over. And this has always been the boogeyman, of course. And, in fact, it's nationalism that they were more concerned about, not communism. They dressed it up as communism.
It is interesting that they felt the need to put the lipstick of anti-Sovietism on the face of all this. These recent revelations make it clear that that was the pitch, that the Soviets would take over, that the communists were using Mossadegh and would eventually supplant him. But there's no actual evidence for that at all. The evidence is to the contrary.
And the Americans didn't believe that the communists would take over, that the Truman administration. I found the most astounding thing in this new revelation this week in the anniversary of this of the Iranian coup, that the Americans did not think the Soviets were a threat, even after the 1949 coup, in which they thought the Soviets were some kind of threat in Syria. Now, Russia had occupied parts of Iran right after the war, but they withdrew. So it was really all about the oil company. It's about nationalism. It's about economic and strategic interests, not spreading democracy. If you watched any of that Democratic National Convention this week, you had John Kerry and Colin Powell coming out, and the old tropes about exceptionalism and America spreading democracy. The sad thing, George, I think, is not only do a vast majority of American people believe this or don't have other information, but I think that American leaders and the bureaucracy, many of them believe it themselves. Take Ukraine. They overthrew a democratically elected, OSCE-certified elected president, Viktor Yanukovych. And what happened? It led to a civil war and killings and still a destabilized Ukraine. But they got their contractors in there, particularly in Iraq. They got the contractors in. They took out the guy they didn't want in there anymore. And chaos might be what they're able to live with, some low-intensity counterinsurgency that can go on and make huge sums of money for contractors for military industry and keep out of power someone who would be independent. They'd rather have this kind of bloody chaos than a functioning democratic state that is independent from the U.S., such as Mossadegh would have been, such as Yanukovych wanted to do by going with the Russians rather than the Europeans, such as Allende certainly was doing with his socialist reforms and Arbenz with his land reforms in Guatemala. They can't stand that. They cannot stand an independent democratic country that's not bothering anybody. They have to meddle either as a democratic leader or a dictator. They want to meddle if it's not the guy that they want.
These color revolutions of the last period, of course, are continuing. The events in Belarus are the latest example. A president of an independent country comes up with, from my point of view, a scarcely credible election result, but you wonder what the result of the last election in Saudi Arabia was, or in Egypt. We hailed the re-election of General Sisi with 97% of the vote. At least Lukashenko restricted it to 70, but an obvious authoritarian leader, strong man, almost certainly manipulated election. And suddenly we look like we're gearing up for another one.
I'm glad you pointed out that Lukashenko is not a Democrat. And I think it's important to people who are critical of American meddling and all the things we've been talking about to also recognize that he brought a lot of these problems on himself. There is, I think, legitimate dissent. What happens is the U.S. manipulates and manages that dissent and helps to organize the protests. I think we saw that in Ukraine. There was certainly legitimate protests against the elected leader in Ukraine. I think there's a good deal of industrial action that's going on in Belarus. That's a legitimate dissent against Lukashenko. But you should put that aside. We can hold in our mind two ideas, that the guy's not democratic. He's a strong man, as you say, but also the U.S. could be and very well likely is meddling. And the National Endowment Democracy, as we know from the 1991 article in the Washington Post, is doing the job the CIA openly, what the CIA used to do covertly, which was to destabilize government that the U.S. didn't like. And the NED has had 34 projects in Belarus over the last year. What we don't have in Belarus, I should point out that we did have in Ukraine, is American senators like John McCain and the Undersecretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, going right down into the Maidan in Kiev and handing out cookies and speaking and coddling and encouraging the protests. It's extraordinary, George. It would be like the deputy foreign minister in Russia or a huge figure in the Duma going down to Zuccotti Park in 2011 with the Occupy Wall Street and making speeches and handing out cookies there. How would Americans have responded to the Russian ambassador showing up in New York during Occupy Wall Street? That's precisely what happened in Ukraine, but that has not yet happened in Belarus. One reason is the U.S. only had the diplomatic relations restored with Belarus in April of this year. So they only installed now a U.S. ambassador.
Joe Lauria, your Consortium News, still doing marvelous work.
That interview was by George Galloway on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts like listeners to KZYX from Willits and KMUD from Miranda, California did this week. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. An Iranian drug official says that the production of narcotics in Afghanistan has seen a 50-fold increase in the past 17 years, including 80% of the global opium crop. Cuban officials say that despite the pandemic, the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the U.S. has intensified. Jeremy Corbyn has called for British intervention. Gaza has been bombed every night since the United Arab Emirates and Israel agreed on diplomatic relations. New York protesters called on Governor Cuomo to tax billionaires rather than cut funding to life-saving services. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A high-ranking Iranian official says the production of narcotic drugs has seen a 50-fold increase over a span of 17 years in Afghanistan, adding that U.S. planes, as well as those belonging to the U.S.-led military alliance and NATO, are engaged in transporting illicit drugs in the war-torn country. The Director General of the Iranian Drug Control Headquarters made the announcement. In the year 2000, the total production of narcotics in Afghanistan stood at about 200 tons, which rose to over 9,000 tons in the year 2017. Based on reliable information, planes operated by NATO and the United States transport these illicit drugs in our neighboring country. The United Nations says that more than 80% of the world's opium is produced in Afghanistan, and the bulk of narcotics produced in the country is destined for European states.
The president of the National Assembly of People's Power of Cuba, Esteban Lasso Hernandez, stated that during the pandemic and in spite of the international demand, The economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed for 6 decades on the island by the United States has intensified. Speaking at the recently held 5th Conference of Presidents and Speakers of Parliament, Lasso underlined that the genocidal blockade not only transgresses the human rights of Cubans, including their legitimate right to development, but it also curtails and offends the sovereign right of all countries to interact with Cuba. British politician Jeremy Corbyn has urged the United Kingdom government to urgently lobby the U.S. administration to end economic, commercial, and financial blockade against Cuba. Despite the illegal U.S. blockade, Cuba has shown international health solidarity with more than 30 countries during this pandemic, Corbyn tweeted. Likewise, the politician urged his million of followers to join the call to the British government to urgently intercede before U.S. President Donald Trump to lift the blockade.
Israeli artillery units over the weekend struck the southern flank of the besieged Gaza Strip as the Tel Aviv regime presses ahead with its acts of aggression against the Palestinian coastal strip. The Palestinian Information Center, citing local sources, reported that Israeli tanks positioned at the fence separating the Palestinian territory from the occupied territories opened fire and struck an observation post east of Qusais town early on Saturday. Sources added that over the weekend, the Israeli forces targeted another observation point in the Muammar neighborhood on the outskirts of the border town of Rafah. Meanwhile, a British-Palestinian political commentator has argued that Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been bombed every day for the past 11, 12 days since the United Arab Emirates and Israel struck a deal to establish full formal diplomatic relations last week. For these days, Israel has bombed Gaza every night, terrorizing the population. In addition, the only surviving electricity plant has now run out of fuel, plunging the Gaza Strip into darkness and impacting all aspects of normal life. According to the deputy chair of the British-Palestinian Policy Council, he spoke with the TRT World Television Network from London. In New York City, protesters with the Make Billionaires Pay campaign are demanding Governor Andrew Cuomo support a tax on the wealthy rather than cut funding to life-saving services. According to Citizen Now New York, 2 million state residents in New York State are struggling to meet basic food, housing, and healthcare needs, while New York's 118 billionaires increased their net worth by $77 billion so far during the pandemic.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is being rebuilt and has not worked well this week at radiohc.cu. It should be fixed by next week. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. This shortwave report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. This shortwave report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.